It's true. Across the globe, women aren't as prosperous as men. Gender inequality is a pressing moral issue, but we forget it has massive economic implications. If you were to put all of the women who don't have access to formal financial services in one place, they would make up the third largest country in the world. That means an entire population without bank accounts, credit cards, or other tools you and I likely benefit from daily. Prosperity for women starts with inclusive policies, products, and people around the globe, and the investment to make it happen. Welcome to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast. My name is Sonia Kelly, and I lead Women's World Banking's proprietary research division. Join me as I speak with changemakers around the globe to deconstruct the social and economic exclusion women face. We'll discover new evidence together and drive action to accelerate women's economic empowerment. Because a leg up isn't a handout, it's a global game changer. Indeed. Hello and welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast, now streaming on YouTube and available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Sonia Kelly. If you're listening on YouTube, you'll be able to find additional insights and resources linked in the description of the video. And my guest and I will be sharing a lot of resources, so you're going to want to check that out. For those of you who are listening for the first time, let me tell you a bit about Women's World Banking and why we're here. We're stepping into our 45th year, and we are an international nonprofit that's hyper-focused on economically empowering low-income women through financial inclusion. This means she has access to and leverages the power of financial services to better her life. We partner with financial services providers around the world on women-centered practices and products. We workshop with policymakers, inclusion frameworks and applications, and we supercharge innovative providers driving financial inclusion through investments and technical assistance via our asset management arm. And those nearly 1 billion women worldwide who are underbanked or unbanked are who we care about. And since you're here with us, you care about them too. Before we get started, I'd love to give a special shout out to Women's World Banking's core funders for enabling our strategy, and that includes Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, and Visa Foundation. Today, we're going to dive deep into the standout drivers that fueled women's financial inclusion in 2023. But we're not just stopping at a retrospective. We'll be dissecting the tangible progress achieved by outstanding players from fintechs to regulators across the globe. To close out the episode, we'll deliver an insider's forecast on what the financial industry can anticipate and what's worth keeping an eye on in 2024 regarding inclusion. Since we're planning on covering a huge timeline here today, I'd love to give us some reminders of what we saw in 2023 together. So first of all, it's hard to believe, but I would say that 2023 was probably the year we saw much of travel and in-person activities resuming after over 2 years of COVID mitigation measures. Of course, we had like fits and starts before last year, but last year just seemed like a more normal year to me. And this also meant the end of COVID-19 related government-to-person relief payments across the globe. We also saw the crisis of global displacement at an all-time high last year, and we talked about that on the podcast. There was the rise in refugees and displaced people driven by the Russian war on Ukraine, the Israel-Palestine conflict, and importantly, by climate events. And we talked about this in a past episode, like the ways that financial services could come alongside of people in displacement. Speaking of climate as well, the Global Climate Conference or conferences around the world included COP28, and that was held in the United Arab Emirates. There was also Climate Week in New York. According to the UN, we ended COP28 with an agreement that signaled the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. And from our perspective, all of these events and what we heard across the world meant that there was just this like strong call for the financial services industry to commit wholeheartedly to working on climate resilience, climate adaptation, and climate mitigation. And Women's World Banking published our own climate research agenda calling for investment in more research to truly understand the needs of women who are facing climate-related risks and impacts. I'd say as well, in 2023, there was a really exciting focus on artificial intelligence and machine learning and the possibilities that these new technologies offer. ChatGPT also democratized, I'd say, the daily use of AI and machine learning and predictive algorithms. And for us at Women's World Banking, this also meant thinking about new possibilities for inclusion and new risks of exclusion for women. And that was another topic on the podcast. And finally, in terms of like global headlines, the G20 was held under the India presidency this year. And one of the big topics of conversation at the G20's Global Partnership for Financial Inclusion was the importance of digital public infrastructure. And we might get into that today as well. On a more personal note, I was able to get back to some travel for work in 2023. And one of the places I went was Cambodia. And along with my Southeast Asia colleagues, I was able to conduct a workshop with the Ministry of Women's Affairs, the National Bank of Cambodia, which is the central bank, and representatives from across the banking sector. And one thing we looked at was the potential of digital financial services, which is something we've been talking about, of course, for the last decade. But I was stunned in Cambodia by the broad availability and use of personal mobile technology for all aspects of life. A woman in Cambodia is nearly 100% likely to have a smartphone and is also very likely to be using mobile internet for her daily life. One of our partners in Cambodia, Wing Bank, started as a digital payments company a number of years ago, and it's now become a fully fledged bank with more than 13 million customers out of a Cambodia population of just over 17 million. So nearly everybody who can have a Wing Bank account has an account. And I think this explosion of digital is offering new possibilities for customers and financial institutions alike. And I'm excited to see where it takes us. So there's a lot here to discuss, and I'm really looking forward as we're coming into 2024 for what all of this might mean for the future. But enough from me. I'd love to introduce our guest. My guest today is Leora Clapper. She is a lead economist in the Development Research Group at the World Bank. She's also, and this is where you might know her name, she's the founder of the Global Findex Database, which to us in the industry is like our Bible, our North Star, our State of the Sector report. She's also, though, she does other things. She's the co-editor of the World Bank Economic Review. She was the director of the 2022 World Development Report Finance for an Equitable Recovery, which is a really important and turnkey report. She's widely published. She has a PhD. I could go on and on and on, but and I'm sure we'll get into some of your bio, but Leora, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you.
I always like to start by asking our guests about their origin story. Leora, could you share with our listeners your journey into financial inclusion?
Sure. And thank you again, excuse me, for the invitation to join you. I've been an economist at the World Bank for over 20 years. I joined after getting my PhD from NYU Stern School of Business. I'm third generation Brooklyn, and I was always intrigued by the pockets of immigrant communities and really the social networks that help support local businesses and help support friends of mine and colleagues to get an education. And so I've worked on a wide range of economic questions over my career, mostly on supply chain financing, how small firms can leverage their relationships with larger, higher quality firms, access financing and technology adoption, as well as how employers and buyers can support financial inclusion through the digitization of payments. And so ultimately, I'm interested in how digital financial services, such as making it easier for women to save, receive their wage payments, or receive money from family living overseas, can help support their family goals to invest in business and educational opportunities, as well as their shorter-term goals of simply affording housing, food, healthcare, and schooling for their families.
That's great. And I love your origin story because it's about the usefulness of financial services, or like what's driving you is the usefulness of financial services, not just you know, not just some goal of everybody having access, but like everybody using financial services to achieve their goals. I'd love for those who aren't aware, who have been maybe living under a rock, for those who aren't aware, aren't familiar with the Global Findex, from my perspective, this is a pivotal cornerstone turnkey contribution that you've made to the financial inclusion space. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about that product that you put out every few years at the World Bank.
Sure. So for a long time in the world of financial inclusion, there was no reliable data that really quantified who did and did not have an account, how account owners used and benefited from that access, and what barriers existed that kept the unbanked from account ownership. So to be clear, there were individual countries for which the data was available, but not in a way that allowed for consistent cross-country comparisons. And so there are also central bank requirements around what we call supply-side reporting, directly from the suppliers of financial services, directly from the financial institutions. That data typically tells only part of the story about financial inclusion, you know, such as how many registered accounts there are with the institution. But that data also has other limitations, and that it's often not gender disaggregated. And it's not always duplicated so that one person with multiple accounts doesn't get double or triple counted. It also doesn't include specifics about how people use their accounts or which accounts are dormant. And so we had, in short, a big data gap. So in 2010, in partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and with our data collection partner, Gallup, I developed a plan for the first global demand-side survey of financial inclusion, the Global Findex. So it's a triennial survey of a population-weighted sample of regular citizens in over 140 countries, representing about 98% of the world's population. And so over the calendar year, we asked over 150,000 adults about whether they have access to financial services and what kind, about their habits as it relates to financial usage, and about issues of financial well-being, such as the ability to use their account on their own, to recover from income shocks or climate shocks, and to deal with stressful events with financial impacts, like a job loss, an illness, or a natural disaster. In 2024, we'll collect the fifth round of Findex data, and to this day, it continues to be the only demand-side global source of data on financial inclusion. And we're really proud it's used by the United Nations to define Sustainable Development Goal 8.10 around financial inclusion, by the G20 to benchmark financial inclusion progress, and to inform national financial inclusion policies by many developing economies. And perhaps most importantly, it's the only source of gender disaggregated data as a source of women's economic empowerment, about women's account ownership around the world.
Fantastic. And for those who didn't catch it, Leora dropped a big announcement, which was in 2024, they're collecting the fifth round of Findex data, which is so exciting. I'd love to get into that when we talk about 2024 and what we're looking forward to, Leora. So don't touch that dial. But before we get to 2024, I want to think back to 2023 and reflect. And Leora, for those listening, is the perfect person to do this with because she has this vantage point on the industry that is so informed by what she's hearing from the consumers of financial services. I'd love to start with a big picture topic. So in 2023, I saw so many calls for collaboration between financial services providers and other services. So not non-financial services. And you served on the GPFI in 2023 in India, as did we at Women's World Banking. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the interplay between financial services on the one hand and digital public infrastructure on the other hand, and how those things work together, what we learned in the past year.
Sure. So in the past, we at the Global Findex, we tend to think about financial inclusion as having three pillars. There's first access, that is, you know, can you appropriately and conveniently access financial services? Are they available to you in a way that you can take advantage of, especially perhaps for women who, because of either social norms or family responsibilities, may be harder for her to travel to a city to access a bank branch, for example. Second is usage, that is, which financial services do you use? And third, well-being, which is concerned with the ways in which having access to financial services enables you to take care of yourself and your family and invest in your future. So these are the three pillars that cover a lot of ground. Even they can overlook the infrastructure and personal experiences that are precursor to access, especially for people who are typically underserved by the traditional financial system due to low incomes, low education, marginalized social status, rural residency, and much more. I refer to that as infrastructure and experience as financial readiness, which includes the physical and digital infrastructure that people need today to be able to access and use financial services, such as access to a mobile phone, a personal SIMS card. It also includes in consumer protection laws and financial wherewithal to use services independently, safely, and to their benefit. And so the first category of infrastructure is often where we think about digital public infrastructure. This includes government-issued IDs, which we collect data on, internet and mobile network access, phone ownership, open loop payment systems, and so on. So the Global Findex data consistently shows a correlation between not having a bank account, not having a government-issued ID, and or not having your own mobile phone. In fact, lacking ID and or a mobile phone are consistently cited by the unbanked adults among the primary reasons why they don't have an account, either with a bank or other similar brick-and-mortar institutions, or certainly a mobile money account. And it probably does not surprise you to hear that women are more likely than men to say they lack an ID and or their own phone. And so beyond knowing that lack of DPI can inhibit financial inclusion, there's also evidence for the opposite. That is that countries whose governments invest in digital public infrastructure show strong patterns of growth in financial access and usage. So specifically around 1 in 3 banked adults in developing countries open their first account to receive a direct payment from the government or from a private sector employer. So in this way, we see that when governments invest in the digital public infrastructure around payments and use it to digitalize the government payments, they can motivate more account opening and more usage of these accounts.
That's great. And when you were talking about mobile phone ownership, SIM card access, consumer protection, government IDs, like all of these elements that come together for, as you said, financial readiness, which I love that term, I couldn't help but think about two things. One is the example of India, and I think it's no coincidence that India hosted the G20. The GPFI was really focused on infrastructure, but I've heard it said that India accomplished an estimated 40 years worth of development progress in less than a decade. On financial inclusion because of this digital public infrastructure piece. So that was the first thing it made me think of. The second thing is a resource I think all of our listeners should be aware of, which is the Reaching Financial Equality for Women report, which Leora co-authored and Women's World Banking collaborated on. This to me is like the seminal resource. It's just a really easy to understand list of elements that contribute to financial equality for women, including government-issued ID, including consumer protection, including the mobile phone connection. And I think that'll be a great resource to share with our listeners. One, Leora, another question for you. This is related. I heard from this past year from a lot of big thinkers in the industry the point about financial inclusion having to be meaningful. So like we're no longer simply striving for the goal of financial access. I mean, we never really were, but that was like an easy goal to anchor on, I think, for a lot of us. We're no longer just looking at access anymore. We're looking for meaningfulness of or meaning of financial inclusion in people's lives. And a paper there was the report that said digital financial inclusion enables 13 of the 17 SDGs, which I believe you were very involved in. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, like what you saw in 2023, either in terms of the rhetoric around this, like it seems like the industry is kind of shifting the way it's talking about financial inclusion, but also in terms of meaningful economic empowerment impacts of financial inclusion. And again, you're well positioned to talk about this because of the global voices using the Findex data to benchmark progress and the Findex data now including like a host of of indicators that go beyond access and help us to interpret the usefulness of financial inclusion.
So thank you. And it's a wonderful report showing the impact of financial inclusion to help us achieve each of the sustainable development goals by goals, providing a summary of related literature, academic studies, as well as just case studies, examples from countries around the world. So we now have a generation of literature showing the impact of access to financial services, especially digital services, on people's livelihoods and on achieving the SDG goals. So there's research linking the financial inclusion to many of these development goals, if not all the goals. You know, for example, just starting with SDG 1, eradicating poverty, a seminal study by Jack and Suri found that the incredible success of the M-Pesa mobile money product in Kenya was found to have lifted as many as 194,000 households, 2% of the Kenyan population, lifting them out of poverty. It also improved the economic lives, especially of poor women in households where women is the breadwinner, which also addresses SDG 5, gender equality. There's related literature from around the world, Nepal, Kenya, Philippines, showing that just offering a woman an account increases household spending on education, on healthcare, on nutritious food. There's also important links to SDG 4, education. You know, for example, research finds digitizing teachers' wage payments resulted in a 92% decline in the cost of the teachers, the cost for her salary collection, of picking up her money, whether that involves bus fares, garnished wages. It fell from $25 per paycheck to only $2 per paycheck. And since they did not have to commute to collect their wages, these teachers saved money on transportation, and they spent more time in the classroom. It's also safer to have the money deposited into an account rather than for her to take a bus with a wad of cash in her pocket. So these are the type of spillover effects that we try to highlight in various studies.
And for those listening, that paper is called Igniting SDG Progress Through Digital Financial Inclusion, and it's UNSGSA. We have to give credit, and we'll link to it below in the comments here if you're listening on YouTube. Leora, one really interesting insight that we just published at Women's World Banking in a report that looked at women's economic empowerment among artisans in Indonesia, we found this really interesting thing that financial inclusion plus income, so like the interaction effect of financial inclusion and income, was stronger than income alone in economic empowerment, which, I mean, for those of us who are in the industry, like this is something we've seen over and over again. But to me, that was also such a nice complement to what we saw coming out of other corners of the development community, which was we should just give money, which is, I think, you know, there was the paper on GiveDirectly, right? So the paper on GiveDirectly, which now I'm forgetting who authored it. Anyway, we'll put information on it in the chat here. But so it was a great finding in that paper that was then widely reported on NPR that just giving money lifted people out of poverty, which I was so excited to see those clear results in a longitudinal study. And also they were giving money through M-Pesa in Kenya. Like they were giving money through the mobile money network. People had a place to store the money if they wanted to store it and to actively manage it. And just thinking to myself about everything that went into setting up that mobile money system and all of the decades of infrastructure enablement there that allowed for finance for people or a cash payment to translate into meaningful impacts in people's lives. And so I think I'm hopeful that as we turn the corner into 2024, we're going to see more and more of this. That's exciting. And finally, we can't talk about 2023 without talking about climate. Very simply, Leora, what do you see as the role for financial services providers playing in the climate space and in terms of adaptation, mitigation, and resilience?
So this is both an exciting and really important new area of research. So it's the role of digital financial inclusion in addressing climate change. So emerging economies often face higher climate risks with fewer tools to manage them. And so digital financial inclusion can help households and small businesses manage weather shocks and invest also. So on the one hand, building the resilience to manage the weather shocks, and on the other hand, investing in a greener future. You know, for instance, we see smallholders in Mali using index insurance to cope with severe storms, and farmers in Kenya adopting climate-smart agricultural practices through their mobile platforms that facilitate access to greener seeds or fertilizer, new markets, and new financing. And stay tuned for a new forthcoming work I've been doing jointly with co-authors of the National University of Singapore and MasterCard. We're studying the impact of hundreds of hurricanes on retail sales and showing how online sales can help the sellers reduce their losses.
Okay, that sounds amazing. Is that going to be this year, like in 2024, that we'll see that?
Oh, yes. Hopefully shortly.
That's really exciting. Thanks. I can't wait to read that. That's very cool. So this is something that I've been thinking about too. And you put it just so well, higher climate risks and fewer tools to manage them. And there, you know, often when I talk about climate with groups, I say climate adaptation, mitigation, and resilience. There's so much there. There's the need to adapt existing businesses to climate realities. So for women working in agriculture, the need to have good irrigation systems as temperatures rise, or for women working in livestock, perhaps it's to put up a shelter so your animals have a shade. So that's the adaptation piece. There's the mitigation piece with financial services important to actually mitigating the impact of climate change through clean technology and financing for clean technology, which sometimes can be prohibitively expensive. And then I think the other important piece is that we saw in 2023 is resilience. Like in India, for example, we saw massive floods just wipe out entire communities, and they like weren't prepared. They weren't ready. And so now there's this need for financial services, whether emergency payments from people who live outside of those communities or emergency loans or cash assistance being able to be delivered to them, having tools to seek resilience, I think is really important. So yeah, to me, 2023 was like on a personal level, just trying to wrap my head around and understand the importance of financial inclusion and climate. Okay, we don't have that much time. And so I really want to turn to a 2024 look forward. Let's take a bit of a shortcut, Leora, and start with a list of what's in and what's out for 2024. I mean, this is like a little bit gimmicky, but I'd love to hear your off-the-cuff list for what is in and what is out.
Okay, so what's in? What I'm thinking a lot more about, you know, as we're reaching the last mile, we're reaching less financially experienced customers, especially women. We need to acknowledge that there are risks involved in using financial services. So these risks have always existed, but they're exacerbated by digital financial services due to the greater exposure, potential fraud, cyber threats. And many developing economies, the onus still falls on the consumer to protect themselves. So there isn't strong recourse in the event of fraud or a mistaken payment that goes to the wrong person. You know, nor are there consequences that discourage financial providers and representatives mislead customers into buying a more expensive product they don't need or paying an unofficial fee they didn't incur. So in that way, consumers are left to absorb any losses. And for us to continue to make progress on financial inclusion, that needs to change. And so there's growing interest in how to improve financial health, which I broadly define as being able to independently and responsibly use financial products, which requires good product design, especially for less financial experienced users. It requires ongoing financial education and support and strong and enforced consumer protection. For example, the governance of agents and other client-facing staff, the appropriate disclosures and transparency of financial terms and prices, which actually digitization is facilitating. Think about sending text messaging to people at the time that they're applying for a loan. And so there's evidence that digitizing payments can improve financial capability. A study in Mexico found that offering ATM cards to government transfer recipients led to these recipients checking their accounts more frequently, building trust in the bank, and significantly increasing their savings. my work jointly with a colleague at the World Bank and at Harvard in Bangladesh found that factory workers receiving wages into an account were more likely to send remittance payments themselves directly from their own phone without the help of an agent. And our work with low-income migrant workers in Korea is finding that workers learn to optimize their use of a fintech app to send money home, in part through their social networks. There's also research highlighting that digitizing payments is not enough. In the Philippines, researchers conducted a survey to learn about the experience of recipients of an emergency cash transfer program implemented by the government. I found that although recipients were happier receiving their money digitally, they also found that account awareness and use of the accounts beyond cash withdrawals remained very low. And so overall, we've seen tremendous progress in access and usage of accounts. And it's really now time to prioritize helping and supporting people optimize their use of financial services and really maximize the impact that these digital financial services can have on their financial goals and responsibilities.
That's great. And so now what's out?
So what's out? Okay, list a few, perhaps a little less popular. You know, so one, there's an important role for ongoing financial education, improving financial capability and confidence. But we really need to be careful not to put too much weight on consumer education at the expense of well-designed consumer protection regulations and enforcement. Like mentioned earlier, the onus can't be only on the users of financial services to be responsible for safe delivery of financial services. Second, I think the discussion of the gender gap needs more nuance. We cannot look at the gap alone. We really need to put into the broader context of overall reaching underserved groups. And so, again, we look at the FinDex, and we really need to celebrate the tremendous growth in both women's and men's account ownership, both traditional and digital accounts, while finding use cases for the remaining unbanked women who are more likely to be out of the workforce, may not receive a regular income, and are less financially experienced. You know, I'm thinking with partners like Women's World Banking, how to design these appropriate financial products. But again, I think we really need to focus as well on the overall growth rates as opposed to only looking at gaps. Relatedly, what definitely is out is the one-size-fits-all products designed to drive the scale of financial services. An exciting finding in the 2021 FinDex data set was the big use of mobile money accounts for savings. And so although mobile money products were typically designed or created for payments, and about half the population of sub-Saharan Africa uses a mobile money account to send or receive domestic remittances, we'll hopefully see providers catching up and offering products to make it easier for people to save and meet their financial goals.
That's, yeah, and plus one on that one, the one-size-fits-all approach is not... I agree. I think it's going to be out. So, okay, I'm going to do it too. And I'm going to start with out and then I'll go to in. So we'll end on a high note. So I jotted down a list in preparation for this call because I knew we were going to be talking about this. So my first what's out is similar to yours and one size fits all. I think gender neutral design is out. We have so much data on women customers. We also have so much technology that can help to tailor products to customers in lower cost ways. And I think providers don't really have the excuses they had in the past to say, oh, gender neutral design works for everyone. So that's one. Second, I wonder about mono product institutions. Not that they're out, but I think they're going to find as we move forward 2024 and beyond that they'll have some big challenges as customers get more sophisticated and need products for more things or need more products for more things. My last one is bias. I think bias is out. It's getting old and but more importantly, like regulators are paying attention to new technology and saying, like, what are the risks of new technology? And new technology also gives new possibilities for monitoring bias in financial services. And so that's my last out. And then moving to what's in, I think one is, and this is, you know, maybe I'm like this is just an expected response from me, but actual research on women's financial inclusion and climate. I think we have a lot of numbers we're throwing around and a lot of assumptions, but I really want to see more studies on women's financial inclusion and climate. I think also gender representation in fintech. I'm seeing investors call for more women at the table in the fintech space. And I think that's really, really exciting. And I think 2024, like this is the year for it. As well, capitalizing on something we mentioned before, a clear vision for what meaningful financial inclusion looks like as we solve the access challenge. And I think that's kind of the next big mountain to climb for us. I could go on and on. There's a lot I'm looking forward to in 2024 and a lot of trends I'm watching, but I think those are maybe the top three. Okay, Leora, is there a major industry moment or movement that you're looking forward to in 2024?
So as you mentioned, first, as we highlight in reaching financial equality, it's important not only to have women on the boards and as the investors at the table, it's also really important to get women in client-facing roles, women agents, women bank staff. And this is research showing how important that is. And so the greater trend towards greater women's labor force participation, reduction in biases will hopefully bring more women to these positions. Major moments. Certainly, I think the greater use of leveraging technology. And it's both the mobile money model in Africa, getting more people to use their accounts to save and for certainly a wider array of financial services. But it's also mobile banking, which we're seeing from Brazil to Egypt, the Philippines, where people are also leveraging their phones and new technology to access their accounts at traditional financial institutions, which will greatly improve access and usage, especially for women. We summarized the literature around the benefit to digital financial services for women, as that gives the woman greater privacy, security, and control over her money. And that's what's really key. So once we digitize the payments, whether it be government support payment, a wage payment, or remittance payment, relief payment from a climate event, it allows the woman a more comfortable seat at the table to decide how the money is spent with her household.
That's really important. And I feel like we've learned so much in the last few years about payments, given COVID-19 relief as the 2022 edition of the Findex with the 2021 data reminded us in its title. I was just referencing it in a paper I'm writing right now. And so remembering that COVID is in the title, and we've learned so much about how to distribute payments, what features need to be there in order for this channel to be useful, how the industry can come alongside of people when they need assistance, either from a government or from a friend in another country after they've migrated or some things. I think those are really important. Okay, so I promised our audience that I would come back to the Global Findex, and you mentioned that you're going to be collecting the fifth round of Findex data in 2024. So I'd love for you to share what you're looking forward to from the perspective of your own work, because we're all watching this space, Leora.
So 2024 is a big year. It's a data collection year for Global Findex. So we spent most of 2023 finalizing and piloting the latest survey of the questionnaire. We piloted it in Malawi, Zambia, Ghana, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. We fine-tuned the survey every round. We retired questions that are no longer relevant, and we added new ones that reflect changes in the market. Yeah, I like to say we're asking questions that are about products that weren't dreamed up in 2010. So, for example, the first round of Global Findex data asked about writing checks. We don't ask that question anymore. Now that we're in 2024, we've seen dramatically expanded use of digital payments in a wider variety of contexts, especially with merchants. With that expansion, we need to understand more about the depth of digital payment adoption. We're asking more questions around frequency of use, or merchant payments, for example. We're asking how widely available it is. Are people encouraged or discouraged from using it? Are they being forced to pay extra fees for using digital methods? They do it without help, and so on. We're also including new questions on climate vulnerability and greater nuance on the vulnerability to financial fraud and abuse. We're also really excited about a new demand-side data module we're collecting alongside the Global FinDex data, which will measure how digitally connected adults are around the world. So linking back to our conversation about the ways in which an ID, a phone, or a mobile network are prerequisites for financial inclusion, as for many other basic services like access to education and healthcare, we've developed this questionnaire to answer essential questions about how adults have access to the internet, a mobile network, a mobile phone, people's ability to use a phone or computer on their own, and so on. This is a really important development and resource that we made publicly available and we published alongside the Global FinDex data, and hopefully allow people to go much deeper into these connections between financial readiness, digital readiness, and the development of the ecosystem.
That's fantastic. That is so exciting. And it's cool to hear that this new demand-side module on connectivity is in addition, like it's not going to displace the FinDex questionnaire. This is so exciting. Well, Leora, I'm really aware that we've run over time. Hopefully that's a treat for our audience, and they've stuck with us this long. Thank you so much for your comments, for thinking with me about the future, and for also reflecting with me on the past year. It's been a really fun conversation, and it's been a really exciting time to be in this space. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So again, thanks to all of you for tuning in, for listening. I hate to be cliche and say like and subscribe, but now that we're on YouTube, I can. So please like and subscribe. Follow us at Women's World Banking or wherever you get your podcast, and mark your calendar for our next podcast in February, when we'll be back with another episode on the third Thursday of the month. Thanks so much.